This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, December 20th, 2005. For more than four decades since his death in 1963, John F. Kennedy has captured the imagination of the American people. Myth and conjecture have swirled around JFK, his political legacy, his family, and its multiple tragedies. This is the way the book Ultimate Sacrifice by Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman begins. It is a book published by Carolyn Graff that has received much attention in the press. Today on Taking Aim, we are going to discuss the ultimate cover-up, the Kennedy assassination, and the legacy of Che Guevara. Let's look at what Tom Hartman and Lamar Waldron say in this 900-page book. 17 years ago, Lamar Waldron writes, Tom Hartman and I began writing a book about the battles of President Kennedy and his brother, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, against the Mafia and Fidel Castro. They describe what they call the plan for a coup in Cuba, based upon documents that were declassified, written by Secretary of the Army Cyrus Vance, along with Califano, his assistant, and Haig.
Joseph Califano.
Joseph Califano, who later under the Johnson administration was the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, but at the time was working under Cyrus Vance, and Alexander Haig, who later became much more renowned, infamous for his role in the war in Vietnam, but at this time was also in the Army. And
well, he was the de facto president while Nixon was basically out of commission at the time of the Watergate expose, a CIA operation in itself, but that's another more complex story yet to be told. Alexander Haig was the Bonapartist figure who was preparing for a military control at that moment in time, and he figures in the Amtrunk operation that they talk about in Ultimate Sacrifice.
But for the plan for a coup in Cuba, it was Alexander Haig who was in charge of training the Cuban exiles at Fort Benning and Fort Jackson and integrating them into the U.S. Army. What they talk about, this plan for a coup in Cuba, and it is a document of which they only give a draft, 1 1/4-page letter in their book, but the full document is available on the internet. This is a plan of the military and the CIA reporting directly to Robert Kennedy. And they say the Kennedy's plan was prepared primarily by the U.S. military, with the CIA playing a major supporting role. Input was also obtained from key officials in a few other agencies. But most of those who worked on the plan knew only about carefully compartmentalized aspects, believing it to be a theoretical exercise in case a Cuban official volunteered to depose Fidel. Interestingly, they say Secretary of State Dean Rusk and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara were left out of the loop. The CIA's code name for their part of the coup plan has never surfaced in any article, book, or government investigation, write the authors. Officially declassified in 1999, AMWORLD, that's AMWORLD, is the cryptonym the CIA used for the plan in its classified internal documents. Waldron, however, and Tom Hartman, they developed their own code name for AMWORLD, and they call it C-Day, a name entirely of their own invention, so they admit. And it's important to look at why they call it C-Day, and they use this on every page over and over again. They write, its evocation of D-Day is intentional since the Kennedy's plan included the possibility of a U.S. military invasion. Not just the possibility. Throughout the book, Hartman and Waldron go into detail over and again about the inevitability, about how C-Day, that is AmWorld, was to create the conditions for a U.S. military invasion. But let's get to the real cover-up of this story presented. And this is a book that, although it's nonfiction, really loses the separation between nonfiction and fiction, and it is itself a tremendous fictional book. C-Day, they write, was undoubtedly one of the most secret covert operations in United States history. In its secrecy, however, lay tragedy, and that's hence their title, Ultimate Sacrifice. Even though the Kennedys' coup plan never came to fruition, three powerful mafia dons, Carlos Mosello, Santo Trafficante, and Johnny Roselli, learned of the plan and realized that the government would go to any lengths to avoid revealing it to the public. With that knowledge, the three mob bosses were able to assassinate JFK in a way that forced the truth to be buried for over 40 years. Mosello, Trafficante, and Roselli undertook this extraordinary act of vengeance in order to halt the Kennedy administration's unrelenting prosecution of them and their allies. Now, this is their basic premise, and what we will discuss today is the false nature, the cover-up nature of this premise, and also how they involve in this the attempt to malign, to destroy the legacy of Che Guevara. Ralph.
Maya, the book Ultimate Sacrifice doesn't get published in a vacuum. The authors maintain that they've been working on this book for 17 years. They chose to release it now, and it was released to a great deal of fanfare by the publisher who had embargoed it before. And it was released to coincide with the publication of Joan Mellon's A Farewell to Justice. The significance of that should not be lost on our audience. This is what we call the counterbook. And it is the habit of the agency, I mean now by that the Central Intelligence Agency and the authorities in question, whenever a revelation, whenever a breakthrough occurs in relation either to the execution of John F. Kennedy or the murder state and its various operations to kill political opponents, to invade other countries, when a book is about to be published that has groundbreaking new evidence to expose the hand of imperialism in these events, the ruling class, the Central Intelligence Agency, the murder operatives, the counterbook is quickly brought into play. What we call the limited hangout. And that is the appropriate context in which to understand the ultimate cover-up called the ultimate sacrifice. Because the thesis of the ultimate sacrifice is that the mob done it. That indeed the Kennedy brothers were themselves preparing with the Central Intelligence Agency and the point people for what you are describing as AmTrunk, the planned coup d'etat in Havana, and as we will discuss, the instruments of that coup d'etat were none other than who? Che Guevara and Carlos Franchi, the noted editor of Revolución. These people were supposedly contacted and organized by Harry Williams, a CIA operative close to Robert Kennedy, for the purpose of assassinating Fidel with military supporters within the Cuban military in preparation for a U.S. invasion of Cuba on December 1st, 1963.
And Ralph, not just Enrique Ruiz Williams, that's Harry Williams, they were contacted by Tad Schultz, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist of the New York Times.
Right. Now, the thesis that the mob done it is not a new thesis. Indeed, Jim Garrison's investigation into the assassination of Kennedy, which focused on the role of the Central Intelligence Agency, was immediately countered by the attempt to say that the reason that Jim was talking about CIA is that he was all mobbed up, that he was covering up for Carlos Mosello, Santos Trafficante, and Johnny Roselli. The mob done it, the mob done it, the mob done it, the mob done it. Don't look at the CIA, don't look at the FBI, don't look at the military, don't look at those who wanted a massive 500,000 troop involvement in Indochina. No, The mafia, the mafia, the mafia, once again the mafia. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1975 began its investigation of the Kennedy assassination, Richard Sprague, who was to head up that investigation with Henry Gonzalez, were immediately replaced by Robert Blakey. Robert Blakey, on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency, blocked every investigative lead, prevented any assembling of the evidence about the Central Intelligence Agency, the witnesses who were already ready to come forth. The mob done it. The mob done it. The ultimate sacrifice is the ultimate cover-up. Joan Mellon had produced a massive amount of evidence. As we've had Joan on the show and we've discussed the Farewell to Justice, 1,200 witnesses, all of the documents that established the central role in the Kennedy murder of Richard Helms, director of plans for Central Intelligence Agency, and of David Attlee Phillips, the CIA head of station in Latin America and then in Mexico City. The very people who this ultimate sacrifice represent to be working together with Kennedy in a plan to stage a coup in Cuba, in which Che Guevara and Carlos Franchi are their close collaborators. Talk about a fairy tale.
Ralph, you have to remember that Santo Traficante, Carlos Marcello, and Johnny Roselli, the three mobsters whom the authors accuse of plotting John F. Kennedy's death, his assassination, that they had been involved in Cuba in the casinos. And they had run the casino, Santo Traficante, involved with also drug traffic in and out of Cuba, and especially the casinos. And it was to their advantage to have the downfall of Fidel Castro, who had shut the casinos. At first they'd been left open, but then they were shut after the Bay of Pigs invasion, that these casinos had been closed. So to eliminate the Castro regime was to the advantage of the U.S.
The mafia, and the mob. Although, you know, this is a very interesting story, Maya, because during the time of the Cuban Revolution and the July 26th movement, and I had a personal involvement in that from 1956 on, which is another story, the CIA tried to penetrate the July 26th and hedge its bets. Of course, the CIA and the United States authorities were the prop behind Batista, but they, as they always do, they try to infiltrate and penetrate a revolutionary movement in order to direct it, control it, subvert it, and if possible, decapitate it. And they sent in Frank Sturgis, who is known as Frank Fiorini, Central Intelligence Agency contract killer, and mobbed up as well, and an associate of Jack Ruby. So successful was Frank Sturgis in running guns into the July 26th that at the time of the revolution, he was made the head of gaming and gambling in Havana and the head of the Air Force. Air Force intelligence for the revolutionary government, and he brought Jack Ruby there with Louis McWillie to take over the clubs in Havana. CIA was right there. It's only after, with Che's leadership, the revolution moves left and the property of the bourgeoisie and of the American imperialists is nationalized. Everything that's not nailed down is nationalized, and Cuba becomes a socialist state, that the mob leaves Havana, that the revolution having moved left, the CIA goes into full gear with the mafia to kill Fidel. Santos Traficante, Johnny Roselli, and Carlos Marcello were certainly involved with Central Intelligence Agency plots against Fidel Castro. But the murder of John F. Kennedy was not the work of the mob. That's the CIA itself, and Joan Mellon's book, as did Jim Garrison's investigation, massively and overwhelmingly establishes that with witnesses, with testimony, with documents. There isn't a scintilla of doubt about the overwhelming nature of the evidence showing the hand of military intelligence and the CIA in the elimination of the Kennedy brothers in their internecine disputes.
Ralph, let's look at the fictional story that is created by Waldron and Hartman. Their plan for a coup in Cuba is written by JFK's Secretary of the Army, Cyrus Vance, with the help of the State Department and the CIA, they write, called for the coup leader to neutralize Cuban leader, quote, Fidel Castro, and his brother Raul in a palace coup. What they don't say in their introduction, and they don't tell you at all in the book, is that if you go to this document, the actual document, it also mentions Che Guevara and the president of Cuba.
Ordóñez and Che were first on the list to be murdered. The book tells us, on the contrary, that Che Guevara was, in fact, the one of the key putsch leaders for the Central Intelligence Agency in his out of his disputes with Fidel and the direction of Cuba under the Communist Party. That dispute was real, but that did not transcend the bond between the two men, differences notwithstanding. And the course that Che would take was a course that was antithetical to everything that the Central Intelligence Agency and American imperialism desired, represented, and was determined to impose.
Ralph, they do this all by implication, however, their implication is through a chapter and verse, with even a chapter entitled The Reassessment of Che Guevara.
Oh, there's no implication, Maya. They have him meeting with Carlos Franchi in Paris and joined by Enrique Williams on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency. They talk about Che in relation to the coup. They don't leave anything to the imagination.
The reason I say this is that they write, quote, the palace coup would be led by one of Castro's inner circle, himself a well-known revolutionary hero. The man, the coup leader, would cause Castro's death, but without taking the credit or blame for doing so. The coup leader would be part of the new provisional government in Cuba, along with a select group of Cuban exiles approved by the Kennedys, who range from conservative to progressive. The identity of the coup leader is known to the authors and has been confirmed by Kennedy associates in declassified documents. However, U.S. national security laws may prevent the direct disclosure of past U.S. intelligence assets even long after their deaths, so we will not directly name the coup leader in this book, since we have no desire to violate national security laws or endanger U.S. intelligence assets. Imagine this. There is no national security law that says that non-U.S. nationals' name cannot be disclosed. And if they know this name, the most important contribution they ever could have made to history would have been to disclose it.
Well, Maya, it goes beyond.
In fact, there is no Cuban coup leader.
Well, in fact, Maya, after all, whatever you want to say about ultimate sacrifice, it makes representations that Enrique Williams was the CIA and Robert Kennedy coordinator of a coup plan in Cuba. It names Tad Schultz. It names all sorts of people, and Tad Schultz is being utterly maligned here. We're going to deal with that. But it is rife with exposure of Amtrunk and Amlash, and it imputes to David Attlee Phillips and Richard Helms the coordination with the Kennedy brothers and Cyrus Vance and Joseph Califano, as you mentioned, and Alexander Haig. They're outing them in relation to a murder plot, an assassination plan, not just the murder of Fidel, but the murder of his brother and his closest associates in preparation for a coup that would be immediately followed by a U.S. invasion. What a national security law. They're breaking the so-called national security law. They don't want to talk about, they're not prepared to disclose the so-called leader of this operation in Cuba because they can't bring a scintilla of evidence to blame this on Che Guevara as they want to do. They want to do it by implication, as you say, but they're leaving nothing to the imagination. This is an old game. You say it without the explicit sentence. You say, well, he met with these people, and they describe him to a T. And then they suddenly get coy on you. Oh, but we don't want to name who it actually is. It's just that he's got a beard. He's very famous. He's an international romantic hero. And by the way, he met with the CIA guy who was organizing this, and he met with Carlos Franchi, and he was under house arrest in Cuba, and he was... Hey, what are we dealing with here?
Of course, they say that they were told in a CIA, they read in a CIA document that he was under house arrest. There's no evidence that he was ever under house arrest, and he was appearing publicly. Let's go now right to the details, because it is in the details that we've been able to really put the lie to this book and this distortion, this ultimate cover-up. And I went, and Ralph went, we went meticulously through the endnotes and followed the tracks, and thanks to some of the assassination researchers, we were able to get some of the original documents, and over the next weeks, we will also get more of the original documents, and we have been in contact with Carlos Franchi himself.
I spoke to Carlos this morning. Let me say very clearly, brothers and sisters, Carlos Franchi, the editor of Revolution, broke with Fidel Castro from the left, opposed this, what he calls the one-party state, the autocratic apparatus, from the left. He is a self-proclaimed socialist. He is a libertarian socialist. He is an advocate of international revolution. He is a defender of the struggle of the oppressed in every part of the world. He is alive and well, and is editing a major publication, and is as much a committed revolutionary as the day he was born.
Let us go now to the so-called plots. As I mentioned, the overall plan, that was the declassified name, is AmWorld. And part of it was two CIA coup plots, one of them AmLash, which was the plans that have been most revealed over the years, which are the plans to assassinate Castro directly, whether a poison pen or any number of mechanisms that were developed by the CIA and that involved the Cuban exile community, the anti-Castro Cuban exile community. But another one that they uncover is AmTrunk, A-M-T-R-U-N-K. And this is what they write in the chapter, The Other Plots Against Castro. And this, by the way, is the one that is at the core of what their so-called coup plan is, as developed by Cyrus Vance. There was one more CIA plot to topple Castro that had begun before C-Day materialized, but this one the Kennedys knew about from the start. The CIA codename for the plan was AmTrunk, and it was, quote, now this is important because this is a direct lie. It was the brainchild of Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Tad Schultz. AmTrunk, which began in February 1963, was in some ways a forerunner to C-Day. It also had some similarities to the Cabela operation, that is the direct plans to murder Fidel Castro. But AmTrunk was a separate operation in 1963. This is confirmed by a CIA Inspector General's report about CIA plots to kill Castro, which Helms had prepared for LBJ in 1967. Now, let's look at what it actually says, what they report it says. A CIA AmTrunk document says the proposal for this operation was presented to CIA by Tad Schultz via Mr. Hurwicz, the State Department Cuban coordinator, in February 1963. Also called the Leonardo Plan, AmTrunk's, quote, objective was to overthrow the Cuban government by means of a conspiracy among high-level leaders of the government, culminating in a coup d'etat. Let us go to the actual document. The document is part of the Russ Holmes work file. And Russ Holmes was the CIA liaison after the House, for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And it is a file that consists of 45 to 50,000 documents. And this is document 104-10400-10123, subject AmTrunk operation, and it is a document that is written by Chris Hopkins, who was part of the LAD JFK task force, and it reviews different cables and files that were in the CIA's records. Now, the description is very important. It says, again, as the authors had said, the proposal for this operation was presented to the CIA by Tad Schultz via Mr. Hurwicz, the State Department Cuban coordinator, in February 1963. Now, the next sentence is key. It allegedly originated with Jorge Volsky. By the way, Jorge Volsky worked for the U.S. Information Agency and also as George Volsky reported for the New York Times. And Dr. Nestor Moreno, who refer to it as the Leonardo Plan. Its objective was to overthrow the Cuban government by means of a conspiracy among high-level military and civilian leaders of the government, culminating in a coup d'etat which would oust Castro and the communists from power. AmTrunk, this is what the CIA cryptonym was for it. And what Holmes notes, in retrospect, the activity appears to have been insecure and doomed to failure from its inception, primarily for lack of compartmentation and loose talk on the part of its principals. Note here, this is not a plan of Tad Schultz. It is Tad Schultz reporting to the State Department about a plan originated by a Cuban who actually was born in Poland, Jorge Volsky, and a Cuban exile, Dr. Nestor Moreno. What we have here is not Tad Schultz as the author of this plan for a coup in Cuba, but Tad Schultz working as an asset of the U.S. government, as we had reported last week from the Carl Bernstein articles and also the work of Harrison Salisbury about how reporters in the United States are integrated into the intelligence apparatus. And Schultz was a very close friend of the Kennedys.
Well, Maya, I think so we are able to clarify what we're really describing here, clarify it for the understanding of our listeners. The dispute that we're centering on has to do with the following. Joan Mellon, in her book, describes and documents how Robert Kennedy was running his own operation with his brother outside of CIA to carry out an assassination of Fidel Castro. And indeed, the operatives that were engaged in this were answerable to Robert Kennedy, but the CIA had its own operation, and its own operation was something much beyond that. It included the assassination of the president himself. And one of the interesting aspects of the Robert Kennedy operation was that because it entailed figures who were closely aligned and associated with Lee Harvey Oswald, it meant that after the assassination, Robert Kennedy was in utter dread that the disclosure of his operation would implicate him in some way in the murder of his brother, and he was instrumental in trying to destroy the evidence and destroy the role, the work, of Jim Garrison to terrorize the witnesses, to bribe them. He used various assets like Walter Sheridan and Hugh Ainsworth and so-called journalists in this enterprise. It's well documented, but what we're having here is an attempt to take these plans and to elevate them into an operation that the CIA itself was working on in conjunction with John Kennedy. And it was a plan which they call C-Day that involved not only the murder of Fidel through a putsch, but an immediate American invasion to respond to the success of the putsch in Cuba. And here we have in this book the attempt to absolve the CIA of its plots against Kennedy and to ascribe the assassination plot to the mob and the mafia and to thereby associate both Kennedy brothers with the CIA operations themselves, when the CIA was actually being dismantled by the Kennedy brothers because they didn't trust it, because they feared it, and because they wanted to subordinate the intelligence apparatus to their own designs of the time. They're not designs that are in any way supportable by those who are opposed to U.S. imperialism. But that is another story. And what we have to understand here is that the dispute between sectors of capital, of which the Kennedy brothers represented a very significant component, namely Eastern capital, had to do whether you use massive troop involvement, as in Vietnam, or whether you use killer operations, assassination units, Green Berets, special forces, Rangers, and what have you, and indigenous forces at large. That's the nature of the disagreements here. They have to do with large perspectives on how you make money out of the Imperium, and they fall out over the spoils. The Kennedy execution arises from those dynamics. And the cover-up is to absolve the murder state from responsibility, not only for the assassination of the Kennedy brothers, but to absolve it for the assassinations that unfold around the world and within the United States itself.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We pause now for a brief station identification.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Reverend Jesse Jackson. Please call and support WBAI, Non-Commercial Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Ultimate Cover-Up, the Kennedy Assassination and the Legacy of Che Guevara. Again, about Tad Schultz, who Waldron and Hartman called the brainchild, Amtrunk was the brainchild of Tad Schultz. Throughout the book, they go on in places and discuss how Schultz was working on Amtrunk. But there is no supporting evidence for this. As I mentioned, when you look at the document directly, what you have is Schultz as an asset for the CIA, as many reporters were for the involved in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many of the key journals throughout the United States. He reported what he found out from his contacts to high officials in the United States in both the State Department and to the President and to Bobby Kennedy themselves.
Yes, Maya, that is correct. But Tad Schultz, it's what I would call the limits of liberalism. He published an 800-page biography, by the way, of Fidel Castro. He purported and in many ways was sympathetic to aspects of the Cuban Revolution. He reported directly to the Kennedy brothers. He was, in fact, a close friend of John F. Kennedy. And the role of Schultz in this stuff was to facilitate the Kennedy brothers' designs. But he is not the author of Amtrunk. And he is certainly not in a position to organize a putsch in Cuba with military elements in Cuba. And by fathering upon Tad Schultz's involvement in this, and further, as we will show, attempting to involve Carlos Franchi and Che Guevara in all of this, what we have here is a really, in essence, a defense of the Central Intelligence Agency's own operations, which included the murder of the head of state.
And Ralph, if you look into the documents that are cited by Waldron and Hartman, this file, this 10410400101-23, which is a summary of documents that was prepared by the Chris Holmes, it even says that they doubt that they have doubts about Schultz's loyalty to the United States and that they think he might be passing information to the Cubans via his articles. That is, they write specifically that Schultz's articles could have been used as a channel for providing information to the Cuban government.
Well, that's exactly the assessment of Schultz that is presented by the Central Intelligence Agency itself. He was Kennedy's man. his involvement with the intelligence apparatus was that which was under the answerable directly to Kennedy, the Kennedy brothers. And in that respect, the operations of Robert Kennedy that we described earlier were things to which Shultz would be affiliated. But the Amtrunk and the plans for the military putsch itself are hardly that of Shultz. And in order to father this upon the likes of Tad Shultz, you have to do that in order to absolve CIA of its overall designs and its operational plans, which, as I mentioned, focus specifically and ultimately on the murder of Kennedy.
And you need somebody like Tad Shultz, who over the years had contact with Che Guevara, in order to implicate Che Guevara as the person within the central leadership of the Cuban Revolution who was going to be organizing a coup. And in fact, Tad Shultz writes in the introduction to his book, Fidel, A Critical Portrait. He had his first conversations with Fidel Castro in 1959, shortly after the revolution triumphed, when he was in Havana as a correspondent for the New York Times. In 1961, I accompanied him on a tour of the Bay of Pigs battlefield. He returned to Cuba in January of 84 to interview Castro for Parade magazine, and had the idea for the for doing this biography, this critical assessment. And he spent time in Cuba in 1985, over 7 months, with a series of meetings with Castro, who gave him open access, and then with his wife living there and doing a lot of research. It's important now to get to Che Guevara. We want to spend the next half hour on the distortions involving Che Guevara and Carlos Franchi, because what is written on page 777, after you go through the volumes of this book, the authors write, the Amtrunk operation was also looking for someone powerful enough to stage a coup. At this point, Amtrunk, our team, that's referring to one of the Cuban exiles, Manuel Artim, and then there was Manolo Rey, and then I don't know his first name, Manoyo, who was developing the camps outside of in the Caribbean, in Nicaragua, in Dominican Republic, in Costa Rica.
In Dominican Republic, right. What we're talking about here is Manoyo had a base in the Dominican Republic. He was part of the anti-Castro Cuban, the Gusano apparatus that was run by CIA. And Manoyo was trying to prepare a staging ground in Dominican Republic. But you know what we're really talking about here is another Bay of Pigs-like operation with a couple of hundred men. The way these guys, these authors are representing this, is the full force of the United States being prepared under C-Day for an invasion of Cuba on December 1st. It's nonsense. They had a contingency plan that was being run around the intelligence services and by the Kennedy brothers, but there was no such invasion plan for the 1st of December on any scale.
At this point, they write, Amtrunk, our team, Kubela, who was in charge of AMLASH, those are the direct murder plans, and Manoyo were all part of one combined operation that CIA still called AmWorld, but they lacked someone to lead a coup in Cuba. They write, the combined operation reached a critical juncture in December 1964. Now, remember, this is after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, December 64. Amtrunk's Tad Shultz met in New York City with Che Guevara for, quote, several hours, end quote, on December 13, 1964. On Che's 8-day trip to the UN in December, he also had secret meetings with Senator Eugene McCarthy and former ABC reporter Lisa Howard, who has told the White House, quote, Che has something to say to us, end quote. At the time, historian Jorge Castaneda, who, by the way, is not more than just a historian, he was representative of the Mexican government.
Well, he was a representative of the Mexican government and long linked to American intelligence. So Jorge Castaneda is exactly one of the what you could call an embedded reporter who was with the gentleman killers of the CIA.
Says Che's relationship with Castro was at a low ebb, and, quote, his situation with Castro was untenable. So here they refer to a meeting of Tad Shultz in New York, implying that this is where Tad Shultz is recruiting Che Guevara for the CIA. But if you go to Tad Schultz's book, which is where they source this information, and his meeting with Che Guevara in New York City, you see what they are discussing. He says, Che's gradual withdrawal from economic policy making and his growing concentration on contacts with the Third World, evidently in concurrence with Castro. Guevara enjoyed his mission, seeing it through the prism of revolution making and the contributions the Cubans would offer in this realm. This was the impression I gained spending hours with him for the last time in December 1964 in New York when he came to address the United Nations General Assembly. After we appeared together on a television interview program, we chatted for several hours about Cuba and the Third World. The next day, Che left for Africa and Communist China in what would be his farewell world tour on behalf of the Cuban Revolution. So they are extrapolating from this simple statement of a reporter meeting with Che Guevara and their discussions of Guevara's hopes for revolution throughout the world. They extrapolate on no basis that here Schultz is recruiting Guevara for a coup against Castro.
Well, let's discuss the politics here. The Cuban Revolution, as Che put it so well in Algiers, when in the a major international conference on the overexploited countries in relation to imperialism. At that time, in late 1964 and then in 1965 in Algiers, Che said the following. The instrument of oppression in today's world is not troops crossing frontiers. That's merely the means of coercion. The instrument of oppression and exploitation is the operation of the world market, which establishes fixed prices for commodities and steals the resources and cheap labor from the oppressed of the world. He said, liberating Cuba, in essence, this is Che's comment. I'm paraphrasing it because I have to tell you in my discussions at the time with Che and others, it was very clear what we were talking about. Che was saying this, liberating Cuba was a worthy thing to do, but it was rather like liberating Poughkeepsie. Here we are, 5 million people locked within a sea of corporate capital. And Che launched into a critique of the policies of the Soviet bureaucracy. He says, look at what they're doing here. They're restricting us to a one-crop mono-economy. Sugar for oil. They won't let us have a drop of oil unless we are confining ourselves to sugar. That is exactly the colonial model. A commodity monocrop. Che Guevara wanted to diversify the Cuban economy. Che Guevara said there's no future for the Cuba, for nothing that you could call socialism that he can construct it in Cuba on the basis of the classical colonial model of a one-crop economy. And they were charged with the going prices for oil in exchange for this sugar. He said this is almost an exploitative relationship. He went on to say, and what of the extension of the revolution? If we conceive of what we call socialism as entering the world market and developing Cuba's economy on the basis of a market dominated by capital, we can only do that at the expense of 300 million starving people in Latin America. Is it the struggle for socialism in Cuba? Is the struggle for its extension into Latin America and the world? Well, that analysis and that speech, which was classical of the left opposition to Stalin, it is directly parallel to the analysis that Leon Trotsky made of the so-called socialism in one country of the Stalin bureaucracy. It is that bureaucracy with a 13-to-1 ratio of privilege that requires the autocratic state, that requires the one-party state, that requires the absence of the right to organize a trade union, to hold a public meeting, to publish a newspaper, to even write a letter to a friend that is any independent analysis, the antithesis of what the socialist liberation of humankind is supposed to be. This was the gravamen of Che Guevara's critique of the imposition on Cuba of the Stalinist model. And when Che gave this impassioned critique and analysis in Algeria, and committed himself, as he's done all his life, to the extension of the revolution. He was quickly denounced in Cairo by Khalid Mohiyadin on behalf of the Egyptian Communist Party, surrogate for then the Soviet bureaucracy. And that is described, and that is defined, as a struggle that has continued from only a recent past in Cuba, when Escalante, Anibal Escalante, who had been the Cuban Communist Party's principal spokesperson. This is the same Cuban Communist Party that had collaborated with Batista, that had run the trade unions for Batista, that had denounced Fidel Castro as a bandit, that had supported Batista against the July 26 movement, the same apparatus. And now they were attempting to move Fidel out. And this was done out of the embassy in Czechoslovakia. And it was only Che's organizing of the ranks for Fidel that defeated Escalante. The Escalante affair is an attempt to drown the Cuban Revolution under a Stalinist model. But interestingly enough, as the dependence on Cuba for Soviet oil in exchange for sugar deepened, and the isolation of the Cuban Revolution was condemning it to an inevitable destruction, and Che was reaching out to the world for extension of this revolution, for expanding the base of opposition to U.S. imperialism, 1, 2, 3, and more Vietnams, that Che spread them thin. The crisis in Cuba was intensifying. That is what the leader of the ranks, Carlos Franchi, who was the editor of Revolucion and a man of poor peasant origins, who was a key figure in the July 26 movement, was articulating. Here was Carlos's credo. There is a difference between a leader and a caudillo. The caudillo, the all-powerful, a kind of god on earth, conqueror or hero, Cortez or Bolivar, represents the past with all its present consequences. We expect a leader to emerge as the result of a collective movement, not to command but to obey the people. Economic dependence, misery, hunger, the monoculture, the militarism, the personality cults, the heroics in the one-party system and the bureaucracy, the monopoly of the economy by these forces, force disguised as ideology. If we get rid of them all, now that will be a real revolution. That's Carlos Franchi. That's Revolucion.
Ralph, the distortion of the movement in Cuba, the Cuban Revolution from the left, as evidenced by Che Guevara and Carlos Franchi, has to be buried by authors Waldron and Hartman. And their way of burying it is to say that these heroic figures were involved through the offices of Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tad Schultz in a coup against Fidel Castro. And this is done through wording throughout this chapter, Che Guevara, a reassessment of statements such as, when Che disappeared from sight in April 1965, or his subsequent exile from Cuba, or Fidel's feud with Che in 1963.
Or when they write, Maya, that when Che died in Bolivia, that Fidel was euphoric. That, in fact, they father this statement upon Carlos Franchi. Well, when you look at the footnote, just let me point this out, Maya. When you look at the footnote imputing to Carlos the idea that Fidel was salivating over the death of Che, the source of this is Daniel James. Let's look at who Daniel James is. Daniel James was one of the people involved in something called Operation Success. He was editor-in-chief of the Latin American correspondent of the anti-communist weekly New Leader. He was involved as an intelligence asset in the United States media campaign against Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. In 1954, mid-54, he wrote Red Danger for the Americas, a book that lobbied for the overthrow of the Arbenz government. It was the definitive book on the overthrow. Now, Daniel James, in fact, is a mouthpiece for the Central Intelligence Agency. It's very ironic, all of this, because it was the CIA coup against Arbenz in 1954, Arbenz was a nationalist military figure who was opposed to the United Fruit monopoly of the land in Guatemala, and they labeled him a communist. Che Guevara, with Hilda Gadea, his first wife who radicalized him, was in Guatemala at the time of the coup. It was the overthrow of the Arbenz government that radicalized Che Guevara and committed him to a socialist and Marxist understanding of the nature of imperialism. And here we have this bloody book, citing Carlos Franchi as the source for Fidel gloating over Che's death. And in fact, the imputation to Franchi comes from a CIA operative named Daniel James, who was one of the architects of the overthrow of Arbenz government by CIA in 1954 in Guatemala. That's what we're really dealing with here. They represent in this book that there's a great mystery as to where Che was when he went out of the country in 64 and 65. What do they say? Fidel Castro was sending Che to his expected and intended death. Expected and intended death? Che Guevara was going to the Congo. And why was he going to the Congo, brothers and sisters? Because the legacy of Patrice Lumumba was still alive in the Congo. The CIA coup against Lumumba and the murder of Patrice Lumumba by the Central Intelligence Agency didn't stop there. Indeed, ironically enough, under the Kennedy administration, they were hunting down all of the militants and the supporters of the government of Patrice Lumumba, Antoine Gizenga, Pierre Mulele. Che Guevara was in Congo in an attempt to work with the Lumumbaist movement in a struggle not just for Congo, but for Southern Africa. Everybody understood that the surrogates in Congo were the South African regime and the Central Intelligence Agency. They'd murdered Lumumba. They'd backed Chombe. They'd amputated the two provinces, Katanga and Kasai, that produced 75% of the industrial diamonds of the world, that produced the titanium that was used in the skin on missiles that was essential to American imperialism. Che was there to lead the revolution, coordinate the revolution, to rally and to train and to coordinate the Lumumba's forces in the struggle for Congo, which everybody understood was the struggle for Southern Africa. Pio Gama da Pinto was the leader of the struggle for national independence in Kenya, and he was the editor of a publication called Pan Africa. And it was Pio Gama da Pinto who articulated the need for a struggle to salvage the revolution in the Congo, to beat back the forces of imperialism and of neo-fascist repression in Congo. Malcolm X was in Kenya and Tanzania with Pio Gama da Pinto, and it was Pio who radicalized Malcolm in his understanding that this was an international struggle against imperialism. Malcolm's last year is a direct reflection of the time he spent with Pio in East Africa. That's the mystery of what Che was doing in Congo. Che was working with not only Pierre Mulele, but with a young Laurent Kabila. Laurent Kabila was a Lumumbaist militant who was in exile, and that was Che's mission in Congo.
So, Ralph, he was definitely not in exile, and it is no mystery to those who are familiar with the liberation struggles of Africa and Latin America. And it is no mystery, as they reported as a mystery, why Che was in Bolivia. And that, too, is something of which you have direct experience, but you'll have to say it in a very short time because we're on the end of the show.
We'll give a little synopsis here, Maya, but one of the points that I want to make here is that when Che Guevara was in Paris meeting Carlos Franchi and meeting other Cubans in Paris, Che was in Paris in relation to his mission in Algeria, and he was stopping in Paris, and Carlos was in Paris at the time, and they had a very important dialogue. It's described very well in the seminal book by Carlos Franchi,
Family Portrait with Fidel,
which is a critique of the consequences of dependence on the Soviet Union and the bureaucratization of the Cuban Revolution. It's a brilliant and left and revolutionary critique of the fate of the Cuban Revolution in relation to the world revolution. And Che and Carlos had this interesting dialogue about not just the future of the revolution in Cuba, but the meaning of socialism. And Che had illusions, I have to say, about the nature of the Maoist regime and the Chinese Revolution. Carlos did not. They had a very interesting dialogue about whether, in fact, the Chinese Revolution represented an alternative to the Stalinist model in the Soviet Union. But their dialogue and their discussion was about how to advance the revolution, how to save the Cuban Revolution, how to extend the struggle for liberation, where it could be done, how it could be done, what was the basis for doing this, how you stood up to imperialism. And these are the two men engaged in this dialogue, who are then accused by this rotten book of colluding with the Central Intelligence Agency as point men for an attempt to assassinate Fidel. At one point, they quote Che as saying, "You know, with Fidel, there is neither marriage nor divorce." And what Che was trying to articulate there in a very synoptical way was that Fidel was wedded to a particular mode of rule in Cuba, and Che was preoccupied with the struggle beyond Cuba as it affected Cuba. That played out in a very concrete way. Why Bolivia? There's no mystery about why Bolivia, Maya. The 1952 revolution of Paz Estenssoro in Bolivia left the peasants betrayed. The national bourgeoisie, instead of distributing the land after the oligarchy was overthrown, confiscated the land for the bourgeoisie itself. The Bolivian revolution was unfulfilled. The peasants were chafing. The tin miners felt betrayed. Bolivia was the arena for extending the revolution in Latin America. This was an ongoing discussion between revolutionaries. I can tell you at the time I was involved with Douglas Bravo in the FALN in Venezuela. Douglas wanted Che in Venezuela. These were the parameters of discussion. This is what Che was about.
Ralph, one last statement, because this is another true falsification, and we must end with this true falsification. They write, in our first interview with Harry Williams, who is the man who supposedly gave money to Carlos Franchi to defect and who was leading this coup plan, we were discussing the plan to eliminate Fidel and Raul Castro during the coup. But when we asked Che Guevara too, Harry surprised us. Instead of saying that Che would have to be eliminated too, Harry said, "I got along with Che a lot of the time." If you actually go to the document, the Army document, the draft document for the Joint Chiefs of Staff by Cyrus Vance, that's 198-1000-410-0-3-0-1, it says here that the plans, if there be plans by makers of a coup in Cuba, that there must be the neutralization of Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, President Dorticos, and Che Guevara. So much for the documentation by Waldron and Hartman.
And let me just say this in closing, Maya, and I'll elaborate on it for our program and our listeners in our next show. When I was in Havana in 1966 with Fidel, and we were discussing the question of Bolivia, and we were discussing the question of the extension of the revolution, and we were discussing the question of Venezuela and the FALN, I was saying to Fidel, "Look, we have printing presses here, frankly. What about providing a currency that we make? We'll screw up the imperialist-dominated currencies, and we'll be able to provide the minimum arms for the struggle." And Fidel said, "He's crazy, but he burns with a true flame." I mentioned that episode simply to elucidate the fact that the discussions with Fidel in relation to Che and the question of the extension of the revolution were how to do it, how to accomplish it, how to support it, how to build it. This book is a lie. That struggle is alive, and it lives in the legacy of Che Guevara.
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Ultimate Cover-Up, the Kennedy Assassination and the Legacy of Che Guevara, will be on the WBAA archive at www.wbai.org and on the Taking Aim archive, www.takingaim.info. We'll be with you next week.
Dear listeners, this is Indra Hardat, Interim General Manager of WBAI. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our producers, volunteers, and
please remember that this program